what I'd like to do is go over a number of different areas. So first of all, I'd like to talk about the nature of the three refuges, just a very brief introduction, that's to say the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, and the meaning of this term going for refuge. I'd like to look at some traditional formulations of Sangha, then Sangha in the individual, Sangha and hierarchy, the active nature of Sangha, Sangha as a kind of doing thing, before concluding. Okay. So first of all, the three jewels, or the three refuges and going for refuge. So I'm going to start with one of the six emphases. You might be aware that there are said to be six particular emphases of the movement, and that's to say the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, and the Western Buddhist Order in particular. So six distinct emphases that differentiate us from other Buddhist movements. So there's one in particular that I'd like to start with, but I better mention the other five, or you might wonder what they are if you're not familiar with them. So I'll just quickly go over the other five as well. So the movement is said to be universal, so that's to say it's open on equal terms to men and women, to old and young, to independent of culture or race or what have you. So the movement is universal. The movement focuses particularly on friendship. The movement focuses particularly on team-based right livelihood businesses as a means to practice, as we have in the Evolution Shop in the galleries. The movement involves itself with the arts as a means of spiritual practice. And the movement is ecumenical. So that's to say that it doesn't align, it's not particularly aligned with any specific schools or movements or so on. It draws from whatever of the entire Buddhist world that it feels is useful for us as individual practitioners. So those are the other five, but I'm going to set those aside now. The one I want to focus on particularly is number six, going for refuge, the importance of going for refuge. So when the movement was originally founded, Sangharakshita, the founder of the movement, was considered what it is that unites all the various different schools and movements of the Buddhist world, whichever country, whichever age that they come from. And he went back to this concept of going for refuge, which is a very old formulation, goes back to the time of the Buddha, this idea of going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. And of course that relates then to my overall title for this talk, the Sangha Refuge. So going for refuge can seem something of it might seem like a slightly odd term to use these days when you first encounter it. So what does it mean, going for refuge? So if you look up refuge in a dictionary, you'll get terms such as, explanations such as a refuge is a shelter from something. Going for refuge means obtaining respite from something or obtaining security for something. So if that's refuge, and if we're going for refuge, what is it we're going to refuge from, and what are we going to refuge to? So firstly then, from what are we going for refuge? Well, essentially we need look no further than the first noble truth of the Buddha, the truth of suffering. Which is not, of course, to say that life is entirely suffering. Obviously there's a great deal of positivity and happiness and so on in life, but nevertheless it is the case that there is a degree of suffering, fair degree of suffering in life. It is the case that we will be separated from everything that we hold dear, and of course we have to deal with the stress and strains of everyday life, and to help cope with that we will inevitably seek some form of refuge, whether we're Buddhists or not. We will seek something to alleviate that. We will seek some sort of security from that, some respite from that. So if that's what we're going to refuge from, what we're going for refuge to, I think changes over our life. So when we're very young, as children, we tend to seek refuge in our parents. At a very young age, our parents seem to be all powerful. They can protect us from whatever it is that might threaten us. They can nourish us with whatever it is we need, which seems all, you know, they're almost like gods in a way. But then as we gradually get older, we begin to realise that that isn't the case, that our parents' powers are limited, and they can't in fact protect us from everything, much as they might wish to. So we become aware that they are a partial refuge. In the adult world then, there are a number of different forms of refuge. There are, similarly I suppose, there's family, friends and partners, a network of relationships from which we can seek some sort of refuge or respite, which as refuges go is not bad. They may offer support and advice and guidance and so on. On the other hand, of course, their advice is not going to be necessarily infallible. It might be selfish advice in some cases. And it is the case that our friends, our partners, our family, we will be separated them from some point, at some point. So again, it's not a perfect refuge, although it does have its values. Some people put a great deal of investment into their career and work, which again can be okay up to a point, but it does have its limits. You may have seen for yourself. I mean, redundancy seems to be a part of the working world these days. And I did notice when, quite a few years ago, when I was working at a company, and traditionally people had worked a long time at this company. And there were people there who had worked 20, 25 years. And then they were being made redundant. And some of these people were really crushed, because they felt they'd given so much of themselves, they identified so much of themselves with their role and what they'd done, given so much over all these years, and they were, from their point of view, you know, they were just sort of cast aside when they were no longer needed. But that is kind of, you know, that's the deal, isn't it, with work. So if you do identify too strongly with work, if you do link yourself too closely to your work, then you could end up being disappointed, obviously. Assuming you live long enough, then we're all going to retire at some point as well. So we're going to have to let go of it at that point. Then again, some people seek refuge from the threats and uncertainties of the world in things like money and prestige, status, and so on. Things like cars or their mobile telephones or their houses, getting things that in some way reflect a status that they would like to have, which clearly, you know, investing in this way to build one's status up is quite a hollow way of doing things, and of course it's very vulnerable as well, because you know, should you have a downturn, should you not have any money, should you come into any sort of misfortune, then those things can be taken away from you, and if your sense of worth is built upon those things and they're taken away from you, well, what then? And then probably the commonest of all is so common, in fact, that it's almost seen odd not to, is drugs, basically. And by drugs I mean alcohol, illicit drugs or illegal drugs, and tobacco. And why I say that is because in certain, perhaps for the majority of people, it seems quite odd if you don't drink alcohol, or if you don't get drunk at times. You might well hear for yourselves things like people saying on a Friday night, "Oh, I could murder a pint now." So it really is, you know, a source of some refuge after a difficult day at work, something like that, or a different week at work, going down the pub and getting sloshed. And of course, like most of these things, okay in moderation, but potentially quite dangerous. So all of these things, and you could probably think of more if you put your minds to it, all of these things are partial or false refuges. I don't like the term false refuges personally, because I think most of them really you could say is more a question of being partial refuges. Things like relationships and so on can be very, very positive and helpful and nourishing. So I would refer to them myself as being partial refuges at best. But at worst, they're unethical and potentially dangerous. So we need to be aware of their limitations, of these things that we're investing in. It's not, of course, to say that we shouldn't have a car or a house or a partner or a mobile phone or what have you. Not at all. it's not that they're false refuges in themselves. I mean, a car is just a car. It's not in itself a false refuge. It's our attitude towards it that makes it a false refuge. If we try and get more from it than it can provide, if we try and get from a car a certain amount of status and well-being, when it's just, you know, basically a lump of metal and plastic and rubber, then we're going to be disappointed. So it's that that makes it a false refuge rather than anything else. So a realization of the limitations of these things may lead us to something else, something of a different nature. It may lead us to discover Buddhism and to discover what's known as the true refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, or the three jewels. So we have the Buddha, the enlightened being, or the ideal of the enlightened being. And then there's the Dharma, the teaching, which is not just books and talks and so on, but really anything that helps us along the path to develop. And then the Sangha, of which I'll come into a bit more later. So these are said to be the complete, the reliable, or the true refuges. So going for refuge can seem a bit of it can give the impression of slightly negativity, slightly sort of withdrawing from the world, slightly sort of hiding, you could say. And I have had that sort of point made to me sometimes. It can give that impression. But another way to look at it is that really what we're doing is breaking the bonds that restrict us, that limit us, that tie us to things like anxiety and so on. What we're really doing is endeavouring to gain liberation from the things that hold us back. So it's really liberation that can be our goal. So in any case, it's Buddhism. In Buddhism, it's the three jewels to which we go for refuge. Or at least that's one way of describing our practice in Buddhism. And it's one way that, in particular in this movement, is emphasised. And this is, if you've been to any of the rituals that we have here at the centre, you may have found yourself chanting the refuges in Pali, which is possibly the language that the Buddha himself spoke. So in that way it links us right back to the time of the Buddha and also across the entire Buddhist world today, because all the various different Buddhist schools, or at least a lot of the various different Buddhist schools, whatever their natural native language, they tend to chant this formula in Pali. So I know that when a friend of mine went on pilgrimage to India to see some of the various Buddhist sites, he found himself at a particular place waiting for a group of Taiwanese pilgrims, and they were all chanting the same verses that he knew in Pali. So it's kind of a nice way that we're all linked together in that way. So one way of expressing our aim in Buddhist practice is to say that we're endeavouring to deepen our going for refuge to the three jewels. So which means placing greater reliance on them, placing greater trust in them, trying to put greater confidence and faith in them, the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. I'd like to read just a quote now from Sangharakshita's book, What is the Sangha? Where he was speaking to another chap who I think actually was Hindi, but nevertheless. So a famous South Indian teacher called Swami Ramdas, who died in the early 60s, was once asked, why is it that so many people who take up the spiritual life don't make any real progress? Though they go on with it year after year, they just seem to be standing still. Why? His answer was simple and uncompromising. There are two reasons, he said. In the first place, they have no clearly defined ultimate objective towards which they want to work. Secondly, they have no clearly defined way of getting there. Well, we're quite fortunate then in Buddhism, because we do have quite clearly defined goal and a quite clearly defined path. So we've got the Buddha, the idea of the enlightened being, as a goal, and the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, that which is conducive towards our advancement, is our path. So we've got the Buddha and the Dharma. So what about the Sangha then? Where does the Sangha come into this? So I'll just talk about some traditional formulations of Sangha before going on in a bit more detail. So There's a number of different ways that Sangha is technically defined, I suppose you could say. There's the Mahasangha, which means the greater Sangha, which basically is all Buddhists everywhere in the universe, really. And that could be also be Buddhists who, people who are, you might say, are nominally Buddhist. They grow up in a Buddhist country and they tend to, you know, kind of follow the rituals and so on without really seriously practicing in any way, much as, say, you know, many people in this country are nominally Christian. So it's all Buddhists or people who consider themselves Buddhists everywhere in the world, Mahasangha. Then there's the Order Sangha, which is a Sangha of those people who have been ordained. So it doesn't necessarily say anything about the individuals themselves, just that they happen to have been ordained at some point. And then there's the Arya Sangha. Arya is a term that means, it's the bit that's translated as noble in Noble Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths. But it means something like to be looked up to be revered, or spiritual even, or holy even. Something like that. So there's the Arya Sangha. And that's said to be all those beings that have attained some degree of insight into the true nature of reality. So it could be beings from the archetypal realm, such as you often see in paintings and pictures in Buddhist centres and statues, as well as those human beings who have attained some degree of insight. So that's quite a lofty idea of Sangha. But when we talk about going for refuge to the Sangha, I think it's a little bit more complicated, really. So I'd like to move on now to Sangha and the individual. So you might all know that bit in Life of Brian, where Brian's there at the window and he's got all those followers outside that he's trying to dissuade, and he's trying to get them to think for themselves, and he says, "You're all individuals." And all as one, they reply, "Yes, we're all individuals." You know that business. And one bloke puts his hand up and says, "I'm not." Well, you're all individuals, aren't you? Or are you? Because it's actually quite difficult, I think, to be an individual. We could ask ourselves, to what extent do we really think for ourselves? So, for example, I suppose I can only speak for myself, but people do tend to change their minds, don't they, on a perhaps a day-to-day basis. If I've got a big decision to make, I do like to give myself as much time as possible. I do like the idea of sleeping on something, because it's amazing what a different perspective you can have next morning or over a period of time. And it's quite interesting how our minds can change. Something seems like a great idea when we go to bed, wake up in the morning, and seems like a terrible idea. What on earth was I thinking? So we do change our minds on a day-to-day, not to say hour-by-hour basis sometimes. And also we do tend to change our minds as we grow older, I think. It's said that people become more right-wing as they grow older. The obvious exception being Tony Benn and Dennis Skinner, I think, but become more left-wing. But most people do become more sort of conservative, I think, as they grow older. So we do tend to change our minds, so it's difficult to say what it is we actually think when we do change our minds. It's almost as if we're a collective of individuals rather than an individual. And it's like certain individuals have the steering wheel, are in control at various times. So, we may have, for example, a mature side and a more frivolous side. We may have a conservative side and a more experimental side. Now, I actually think that's quite a good thing, because I think it's very good if you can call on these different qualities depending upon when you need them. It's good to be reliable and conservative and sensible sometimes, but it's also very good to have a playful side and a frivolous side. So I don't think that in itself is a bad thing. Where it does go wrong a bit is if they're all pulling in different directions. And I think you can see that sometimes in some people. I know somebody in particular who's wasted a lot of money as a result of this. And she keeps changing her car all the time. And she, if, at one minute she thinks, I need to have a 4x4. You know, that's the thing, it's fashionable, everyone's going to have a 4x4. And then it's like about a year later, at most, she starts to feel a bit guilty about it and thinks, no, I need something more practical. So she buys a Ford Focus. And then after a while she thinks, no, I need something a bit more sporty. So then she buys something with a bigger engine that's got a, you know, soft top and that sort of thing. And really, this has gone on and on and on for years. And I mean, that's just an example, but I think we can all do that sort of thing to an extent, maybe not quite to that extent, but we can have this pulling in different directions. I think it's another reason why often, we, although we know things can be good for us, we don't always do them. Because although, for example, it might be great to be able to meditate for 3/4 of an hour a day, don't always do that. Although a bit of us would like to do it, there's a lot of us that perhaps wouldn't like to do that. So we're kind of pulling in different directions a bit. Hence meditation. One of the purposes of meditation is to integrate us, horizontal integration, so that all these different bits of us come into relationship with one another and tend to work together, sing from the same hymn sheet, so to speak. Also, we inevitably have a certain way of thinking based on conditioning, based on the group to which we've grown up in, become belonged with, worked with, and so on. For example, isn't it what a coincidence is that nearly all people who are born into Protestant homes in Northern Ireland end up growing up as Protestants and having a kind of generally Protestant point of view and having a certain view of the other people who live over the other side of the wall. And coincidentally, all the people who are born into Catholic households, the vast majority of them, grow up being Catholic. Which is an incredible coincidence, isn't it, really, that it's turned out like that. It reminds me of that joke about, I'm really glad that I wasn't born in Germany because I can't speak a word of German. So it's incredible how much of a culture you imbibe, just like the language that you learn as you grow up. So we don't always think for ourselves. Now this could be a difficult thing to accept, because after all, naturally we think our opinions are correct. Otherwise, why would we hold them? It would be very silly, wouldn't it, if we didn't think they were correct. So it can be a difficult thing to accept, and partly because group membership is, from an evolutionary point of view, very useful. Humans are social animals, and we don't survive very well on our own, particularly from an evolutionary point of view, an historical point of view. And so it pays to be a part of the group. And being outside the group is very difficult and very scary and very, very painful. If you've kind of come across that at all, maybe at school or in work environment, something like that, being excluded from the group is very unpleasant indeed. But group membership is useless from the point of view of the spiritual life. It's useless from the point of view of becoming more and more independent and thinking for ourselves, because group membership works contrary to that. And we need to be as independent as possible. We need to be able to think for ourselves. And of course this includes Buddhist matters as well. It's no good just taking it for granted that I'm a Buddhist, so whatever, you know, I'm told is Buddhist, then simply taking that on board. Everything that we listen to and hear and we're told, we should also question. You're probably aware that the Buddha tried to advocate that kind of policy as well. There's a famous sutta, text from the time of the Buddha, the Kalama Sutta. The Kalamas were this group of people, and they lived on the edge of a kind of forest. And often there were loads of people wandering, mendicants, wandering sort of holy men who wandered around India in those days, I believe still do today. And a lot of them went through to the forest where they could be on their own to reflect and meditate or whatever it is they did. And so they passed through the territory of the Kalamas. And so when they passed through and they got a bit of food and stuff, and they give a bit of a talk. And the Kalamas were getting perplexed, because every week they'd have a new person coming through, and the person would say, well, this is the thing you need to do, what you need to do is do this, and everything will be great. And then the next week somebody else would say, no, that's wrong, what you need to do really is this, and this. And so the Kalamas, you know, were a bit confused. Every week somebody would come along and tell them something different. So they said to the Buddha, how on earth are we, I'm paraphrasing here, how on earth are we supposed to know what's the right thing to do? You know, we get all these different teachers, they all sound very good, and they're all very convincing, and they all tell us something different. And the Buddha said, well, don't necessarily just take it for granted if somebody tells you, even if they do look as if they, I'm paraphrasing the Buddha as well, if they do really look like they know what they're talking about, put it to the test. You know, does it really, is it really conducive to happiness? Is it conducive to liberation? Is it conducive to well-being? If it does, then fine. Then that's something to be honoured and something to work with. If it doesn't, then forget about it. So don't necessarily believe anything anybody tells you. It's you know, put it to the test, test it against your own experience, and so on. Now, of course, this being independent, though, is not being independent just for the sake of it, because that's something else you see as well sometimes. It's, we probably all do a bit. You can be independent just for the sake of being independent. So you can take a contrary view to what the group thinks, because you don't want to be a part of the group, you know, you'll be above and beyond the group, so you take a different view. But taking a different view in order to be independent is not truly being independent, because you're just basing your view still on what the group thinks. You're still being dependent upon what the group thinks. Rather than agreeing with the group, though, you're just taking the contrary view. So that's still not being independent. That's just being contrary. So being truly independent is actually quite difficult. So although we have our goal, the Buddha, the ideal of enlightenment, and although we have our path, the Dharma, the teaching, it can still be a bit of a struggle. If we don't have the correct sort of supportive environment, if we don't have a network of relationships that can support us. Now this, you know, this network of relationships, this environment, is not a group. Because a group tends to want people to think the same. A group is uncomfortable with dissent, and a group will tend to fragment and split if there's disagreement. Whereas, within a spiritual community, schism, that's to say splitting up the spiritual community, is seen as a very serious offence, in fact. So a group is not really an appropriate word for this sort of supportive network of relationships, this supportive environment. So we can use the term Sangha for this, and say that it's something like a healthy spiritual network of relationships. I'd like to talk a bit about Sangha and hierarchy now. So Sangha, the spiritual community, has a hierarchical element to it as well. So this means then that being a part of the Sangha, we would accept perhaps that there are people further along the path than ourselves. Clearly there are people who we might consider peers, who are of a similar level, as a similar distance along the path. And then there are other people who are perhaps newer to the movement, newer to the Buddhism, who are less far along the path, to whom you could say you have a responsibility to support and to help and to provide a positive example. I think in our day and age, our egalitarian day and age, the idea of hierarchy is quite difficult to accept. Certainly for a number of people, except for in certain prescribed places. Specifically, I suppose, work is one environment where we do tend to accept the idea of hierarchy, but outside of work, it can be a bit of a thorny issue for some people in particular. I think it's perhaps why some people, whilst liking the ideas of Buddhism, don't persist with it, because they do feel uncomfortable with this idea of hierarchy. But it's not absolute. It's really an idea, a concept, rather than something concrete. Just because somebody's been ordained for 80 years doesn't mean that they necessarily know any more than you at all. So it's not absolute. Really, it's accepting the principle and being open to the idea that you can learn from other people who might have more experience or more wisdom in certain areas. And similarly, that you may be able to pass on your experience, your wisdom, to others who are not as far along the path as you in some areas. So this brings me on to the idea that the guru, or the teacher, which can be controversial in the West, seems to work quite well in the East, doesn't seem to work quite so well in the West, for a variety of reasons. I think in the West we tend to have one or two approaches towards this idea of the guru or the teacher. We either reject this idea, we reject them and become very cynical about the guru, or we idealize the guru and build them up as something, put them on a pedestal, you might say. Which either option is, of course, flawed, really. If you reject this teacher, then you're avoiding any advice and support, any influence of those people who may have gained substantially more experience than you have. So you're putting yourself outside that positive influence. This is not just useful, I would say it's an essential thing. So you're depriving yourself of that. On the other hand, if you idealise a guru, if you build them up to some perfect being, you will inevitably be disappointed at some point, because there aren't really any perfect beings. So inevitably there's going to be a coming to terms with that, an inevitable disappointment. So there needs to be a middle way, I think, you know, realising that there can be a great deal of positivity that you can gain from individuals, from gurus or teachers or what have you, but at the same time accepting that they're not necessarily going to be perfect. Or as somebody with more experience than me once put it, perfection may come in an imperfect container. So the Sangha can provide an environment in which we can practice, it can be supportive of our practice, and can promote our practice. But I think there's a bit more to say as well. I think there's an active nature of Sangha, or you could say Sangha itself as a practice. I want to read just another little quote from this book. When we're talking about Sangha as a practice, I'm thinking particularly in terms of relationships. And sometimes our old existing relationships, perhaps with our partner or other members of our family or with our friends, but I suppose the most difficult can be with our partner. You know, they can feel, it's difficult and can feel threatened when we start getting involved in Buddhism. You know, not unreasonably, perhaps. And I just found this quote from Sangharakshita, which I thought was interesting. And it's not always emphasized within the movement. So he says that many people find that as they mature in their spiritual practice, their increased positivity, sensitivity, and sense of gratitude brings them into much deeper and closer relationship, especially with their families. And this is very much to be welcomed, and indeed consciously worked on. After all, as the Buddha reminded Sigalaka, our parents gave us this life which we increasingly feel to be very meaningful and precious. Great love and respect is due to them for that, whatever has happened since. So although the Buddha himself went forth, it was physically went forth, it was out of necessity. Whereas, you know, relationships that support, or at least don't undermine our practice, are to be valued. And in fact, I think we have a duty of friendliness to those that we encounter. Positivity. There is, I think, a dynamic nature to the three jewels. The three jewels aren't just idols to be worshipped. Well, I don't think they're idols to be worshipped at all, actually, as such. But they're really kind of active elements that we can bring into our practice, that we can employ in our practice. And so as we try and put more and more focus, more and more reliance on the three jewels, the three refuges, we may, for example, give some things up, like cigarettes or gambling or hunting or unethical friends, that sort of thing. We may decide to assign different priorities. A car's emissions may be more important to us than the car's acceleration, for example. Ethical shopping may become more important to us. And we may place greater emphasis in certain areas, especially with those relationships that we value, family or friends or a partner. And we would expect, as time goes by, to communicate better, to empathise better, to have more patience, and so on. So this all is embodied within this idea of going for refuge. It really is, I think, something about, you know, it isn't just something practiced in the shrine room. It's something on a day-to-day, even a minute-to-minute basis. Going for refuge, in fact, means, to the extent that you're able, trying to bear in mind the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha at all times, as I say, to the extent that you're able. So you can consider, for example, what effect will this have on my development when you're thinking of watching a TV program? Whatever you might be thinking of doing, or whatever you might be thinking of saying, whatever you might be thinking, you know, what effect does this have on my development? We are, after all, always saying something, we're always doing something, we're always watching something. And it all has an effect on ourselves, as well as on the universe in general. So the distinction between our practice and the rest of the world, whatever it might be, TV, football, family, friends, EastEnders, is bogus. It's all practice. There can be formal practice in the shrine room and so on, but then the practice when you're actually out there in the world doing whatever you're doing. You can bring your practice into every moment. So, it's useful to think of the effect on ourselves or on others of everything that we say, we do, and we think. And just to finish off this section, I'd like to talk a little bit about, I'm going to go over briefly, summarise an order member by the name of Sada Loka's explanation of a talk by Subhuti, another order member. And Subhuti was talking about establishing Sangha as spiritual practice. And he covered a number of points, which I think are quite interesting and useful. So the first point was, in establishing Sangha as spiritual practice, is friendship, both vertically and horizontally. So that's to say, both with people who may be further along the path or less far along the path, as well as with our peers, people who are of a similar distance along the path. We can't expect this just to happen, necessarily. Friendship is something that you have to work with, or at least most people have to work with. The next point you mentioned was confession. And often I think our idea of confession in Buddhism can be coloured by the Christian idea of confession. Confession in Buddhism has nothing whatsoever to do with guilt, or at least ideally it hasn't got anything to do with guilt. It really is more of a question of accepting shortcomings, accepting things that we may have done, and endeavouring to make amends. It really is the laying down of a burden. And having laid down the burden, then you can move along more swiftly, more quickly without it, unencumbered. But it is a very challenging practice. And it can only really be done, I think, in a supportive context. So that's to say, perhaps in a going for refuge group, in a chapter, or among very close friends. That's to say, basically, in the context of a Sangha. And then we can, the next concept that Subhuti mentioned was putting ourselves out, thinking of others and doing what needs to be done. Quite often, sometimes it means doing what we really don't want to do. Though often I find that you can be glad afterwards when you have done it. It can be quite satisfying afterwards. But it does mean a question sometimes of doing what you don't really want to do. It also could mean being open, which is in itself an interesting challenge. We could ask ourselves, to what extent do we have a secret life? And why? Now again, practicing being open in this way requires a suitable context. You can't really do this outside of a suitable context. So again, very useful to have friends or a group of some sort, a positive group, going for a refuge group or what have you, where you can be open and honest with people in a supportive, mutually supportive context. Letting go of hurt and resentment, being able to forgive. Making the most of our experience of community, if only on retreat. So this communication of key importance within the Sangha from the dedication ceremony, you may be familiar with the line, may our communication with one another be Sangha. So Sangha is really all about communication. And you may find, but if you've been on retreat, that you may find that quality of communication can increase, can improve. I particularly value being on order retreats at times where the quality of the communication can really be very, very positive and enjoyable, really. It seems as though there can be less manipulation going on. People, just talk in a very straightforward way without a particular angle or without thinking, if I say this, are they thinking this? That kind of thing. There's less of that going on. It's just kind of straightforward. It's very kind of refreshing, really. Everybody knows where they are. Very, very positive indeed. The next point that he made is avoiding eternal adolescence, or taking responsibility. The point I would like to bring into this is cynicism, really, which is so prevalent these days, and I think it's just utterly destructive, really. And it's very, very different from being honest, from honest criticism, which is a positive and useful thing. That cynicism is just really very unhelpful. I think people use cynicism to shield their own emotions and to avoid taking responsibilities. Obviously, one of the biggest areas of cynicism is politics. People are very cynical about politics and politicians. And I don't know, people are so upset about politics and politicians. I don't know why they don't, you know, take it on themselves and stand. And if it's so easy, you know, to do a better job, then why don't they do it? Because it has been done. So, but of course, people don't do that, do they? It's much easier. It's quite fun just to criticise, really, isn't it? But, or it can be. But so, in order to help establish Sangha as a spiritual practice, it's important, really, to avoid that and take some responsibility. And then the final point that Subhuti made was understanding that altruism in Buddhism, behind the Bodhisattva ideal, is understanding the interconnectedness of all things to do with breaking down the self-other duality. So, just to summarise where we've been then, we covered briefly Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and going for refuge, and what a refuge is. Looked briefly at traditional descriptions of Sangha. Looked at Sangha in the individual, Sangha in hierarchy, and then the active nature of Sangha, Sangha as an activity. So just to conclude this, what I'd like to say is that Sangha is not a thing, or at least it's not just a thing, it's much more than that. It's something in which we can participate. It is also an environment that supports and promotes our practice, as an activity that is a part of our going for refuge, and then can help deepen our going for refuge, and all of which may indeed lead, at the end of the day, to the attainment of liberation.